the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, celebrating the arts of movement and strength as Canada's Cirque Eloise presents its newest show, Rain, at the University of Illinois Department of Dance. And the Univide Department of Dance showcases student choreography in Studio Dance 1 and Studio Dance 2 performances. Visit KrannertCenter.com for more information. Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first part of the program today, the first hour, we will be talking about the relationship between, basically between three countries in Northeast Asia, China, South Korea, and Japan. In recent years, one of the trends that we have seen in all of these countries is a rising tide of nationalism, which has helped to increase already existing tensions over territory, and also conflicting versions of post-war history, and actually also pre-war history. All three of these countries have many reasons to work together, yet Northeast Asia remains one of the world's least integrated regions. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about some of these subjects with Robert Templer. He's director of the Asia Program for the International Crisis Group. He has a background as a journalist and writer on Asian political issues. And as director of the Asia Program, he oversees projects covering Central Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, and Northeast Asia. He has been a journalist. In fact, he, in the late 90s, was a reporter in Vietnam for Agence France-Presse, and based on some of that experience, he has written a book that was published in 1999, a book entitled Shadows and Wind, A View of Modern Vietnam, and is still available in a paper published by Penguin. He's also been a former visiting scholar at University of California, Berkeley, and is interested in a number of things, including North Korea and nuclear proliferation, as well as issues like Afghan reconstruction, political social reform in Pakistan, and political developments in Myanmar. Questions are certainly welcome here as we talk. The number in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, people have questions, you can call. The only thing we ask is that people are brief as possible, just so we can keep things moving along. But anybody's welcome to call. Again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Templer, hello. Thanks for talking with us today.
Okay.
We appreciate it. Just as a way of beginning, I guess, it does seem noteworthy, at least, when you think about just the fact that these countries and these governments do have many common interests and would have good reason to have closer ties, to work together, to think of themselves as members of a region with common interests. And yet, to date, that really hasn't been the case.
No, it's an area that's remarkably sort of unintegrated in political and diplomatic terms. And yet this is a hugely important economic area. It's really one of the most critical industrial areas in the world. If you think about it, Japan, South Korea, and the huge growing economy of China all linked together. What you have is a situation where the governments are really not even speaking to each other. The Chinese have cut off most high-level contacts with the Japanese. The Korean president recently spent most of his time in a meeting with the Japanese prime minister, lecturing him about Korean view of history. And in many cases, the sorts of high-level contacts that are really needed to move things along and develop diplomatic relations in various ways are just missing.
Mm-hmm. Well, this that maybe we'll jump to that point there, that is particularly tensions between the governments of Japan and China, and perhaps also of Korea and China, going back to the Japanese conduct before and during World War II in Korea and Japan, and the feeling of many Koreans and many Chinese, and perhaps even some Japanese, that the government of Japan, the present government of Japan, has not, to the extent that it should, said, yes, we did terrible things, and not only are we sorry, that we're willing to back that up with some kind of action.
Well, certainly there's a real sense in Korea and China that Japan has not really fully acknowledged its role during World War II. And before that in Korea, Korea was a Japanese colony. People there were treated very brutally for a long time by the Japanese government. Likewise, in China, the invasion happened long before normal span of World War II and involved the deaths of a very large number of people. And there's a real sense that Japan is suffering from a sort of a lack of recognition of its role in this region. And that's exacerbated by visits to a particular shrine in Tokyo by the Japanese Prime Minister. He's been under pressure from right-wing members of his government to visit this shrine and to essentially honor people that the Chinese and the Koreans regard as war criminals. And this has inflamed feelings right across China and Korea and led to really severe tensions among these countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that apparently that one of the things that the Prime Minister, Mr. Koizumi, has said, he said something to the effect of, well, I'm going there not as the Prime Minister of Japan, I'm going there as an individual. And it seems to be a rather weak argument to make and the face of it. And in fact, that certainly it's not an argument that that people in Korea and China are particularly willing to entertain.
No, it's something that infuriates them completely. The reason for this is that in 1978, the names of 14 Class A war criminals, these were people who'd been tried in Tokyo and executed for war crimes during World War II, were added to the list of names of those people honored at the shrine. And since then, some Japanese prime ministers have gone, but it's tended to, since about 1985, meet with some outrage from the surrounding governments. Koizumi's visits there have been very provocative, and they've certainly led to incredible tensions with the other countries. He's claimed that, for example, he doesn't go on the national holiday that honors the people who died during the war. He doesn't wear a Shinto robe when he goes. He adopts a different form of worship. He adopts a Buddhist form of worship rather than a Shinto form of worship. And all of these things signal that somehow he is doing this as an individual rather than as prime minister. But it's really not an argument that flies at all with the South Koreans or the Chinese, who've been completely infuriated by these visits. And what they see as really a lack of recognition and a new assertiveness of Japanese nationalism.
Mm-hmm. This, I think it's obviously there are several things here that are all tangled up together, economic concerns and historic concerns and others. And I guess to think about the position of the Japanese, one doesn't have to think back too far, at least back to the 1980s, when here in the United States, for example, we were consumed with the idea that Japan was a rising economic power. And now that in recent years, more than just a recent few years, the Japanese economy has not performed well, nothing like that it did. And now people are talking about sometime in the not too distant future, China becoming one of the world's great economic powers and perhaps one of the world's great powers. The economy of South Korea has also developed a good deal since. So one can imagine the Japanese sitting there and being unhappy with this kind of reversal of status in the region compared with the Chinese and with the Koreans.
Well, since 1990, what you've seen is real changes in the positions of China, Korea, and Japan. What you have in China is it's gone from being a political heavyweight with a seat on the UN Security Council, nuclear weapons, but an economic lightweight, to being both a political heavyweight and a major economic power that's really driving growth in Asia. Japan has seen its economic power decline somewhat relative to other countries there. And at the same time, it's decided that it wants to be a more normal country, a country that's less caught up in pacifism and the legacies of World War II, more assertive politically. It's been trying to get a seat on the UN Security Council. It's been more aggressive in terms of promoting its own interests. It's been developing its military much more substantially. Likewise, in Korea, you've seen the country move from being a military dictatorship, very much subservient to its relationship with the United States, to being a more assertive democracy. So what you have is different changes going on around the region which have really made these countries rub up against each other. And unfortunately, there's no real mechanism for them to deal with those tensions. In Europe, for example, you have a whole system of mechanisms through NATO, through the European Union, through a host of other institutions that can somehow deal with countries when they start to get into these antagonistic positions. But in Northeast Asia, there's none of that sort of security and political architecture that is really needed there.
Mm-hmm. One could certainly understand that both Japan and South Korea would be concerned, at the very least, by the fact that they had such an overwhelmingly powerful militarily and politically neighbor as China. What does are there particular concerns that the Koreans, that the South Koreans have about China? What can one say about the relationship between China and South Korea?
Well, for a long time, South Korea had no relations with China. China recognized North Korea. And then in the early 90s, that changed, and there was a huge sort of South Korean embrace of China. Huge amount of South Korean investment went into various provinces, particularly the northeast of the country. And you had this absolute love affair between South Korea and China. Since then, a little bit of reality has intruded, and there are rising concerns in Seoul about a number of things. There's some concern about some very distant historical claims over parts of Korea. China's been making sort of subtle moves towards reasserting some of these claims in the north of the country. It's uncertain exactly why they're doing this, and it's really a rather sort of remote historical issue that doesn't really have much to do with present-day borders, but it certainly rattled people in South Korea. And likewise, there's sort of a sense of China as being a little more assertive than South Korea would like, and also perhaps being a little bit too keen on the division of Korea. I mean, for many Koreans, this is a particularly emotional and critical issue that at least at some stage there should be some reunification of the Korean Peninsula. China quite likes the idea of two Koreas in the sense that this keeps the area reasonably weak. North Korea is in some ways subservient to China, and it keeps U.S. forces that are based in the south at a distance from the Chinese border.
Hmm. I guess that you would think that on the face of it that all three countries, South Korea, Japan, and China, would be interested in having a peaceful settlement of the issue of the division and would like to see the government of the North and the people of the North, in a sense, brought into the regional system. If for no other reason, then you would say stability and lessening the potential of conflict would be a good thing.
Well, certainly. I think there is a desire among all countries on one level to see North Korea change. I mean, to see its economy change, to see its government ultimately become more open and more liberal and more in tune with the rest of the world. It's an extraordinarily isolated and bizarre country in many ways. But they all have different views of how to get there. China and South Korea are actually slightly more aligned on this issue. They think steady economic change is more likely to make progress there. Japan has a much more sort of tougher line. It's much more aligned with the current views in Washington. And a lot of this is to do with the issue of Japanese who were kidnapped by North Korean back in the 60s and 70s and the return of the remains of those people and in some cases the actual families. That's been a very contentious issue. Japan still doesn't actually have relations with North Korea. So the normalization process has stalled at the moment over the abductions issue. So the relationship there is very tense. So what you do have, again, is tensions between China, Korea, and Japan over North Korea and how to approach this very, very complicated issue of Korean nuclear weapons and the broader issues of Korean development and integration into Northeast Asia.
Hmm. Yeah, they're not very far away from the region we're talking about. There is a place, and I'm thinking about in West Asia, and the long-running conflict involving Pakistan in India, a place where there is a great deal of concern. Certainly in the past various points, there has been a great deal of concern about the possibility of that exploding into a dangerous conflict. And certainly at the point where both countries demonstrated the capability to build nuclear weapons, then it became the level of concern bumped up even greater. So this is one of those hotspots that people who pay attention to international relations say this is really important, and yet it doesn't always get a whole lot of attention. Here, we're not talking about here now in Northeast Asia any possibility of a conflict that rises to that level, are we?
No, but we are talking about risks in this longer term over potential conflict, and also the failure really to develop the region as successfully as they ought to, if they had the sorts of structures that would mitigate some of these tensions and deal with some of the problems that come up between the countries. There is a real concern, though, about the potential for nuclear proliferation in this region. China obviously has nuclear weapons. North Korea now has them, probably has more than it actually needs, and there's always concerns about whether they would sell them to other countries or to even to terrorist groups. South Korea and Japan have both said that they would not go nuclear. And we do believe that Japan will be very, very reluctant to take that step because of its own history with nuclear weapons. I think, though, that if North Korea were to do something like test a weapon, or if it were to be extremely provocative in, for example, its missile testing, it once sent a missile over Japan, which caused considerable anxiety in Tokyo. If it were to do things like that, then there is a real risk that the Japanese would say, well, fine, we're abandoning our strategy on nuclear weapons, and we're going to move ahead with the development of them. And technologically, Japan and South Korea would have absolutely no problems developing nuclear weapons. There are no technological barriers to them developing the weapons. So there are concerns that down the line, this region could become that much more tense. All of these countries armed with nuclear weapons, all of them engaged in an arms race, all of them engaged in various clashes over territory. There are considerable territorial disputes. And these are critical because of less so for the actual tiny little islands that are involved, and more so for the surrounding economic exclusion zones, which may involve issues such as oil exploration and fisheries. So there are real concerns that there could be clashes, that there could be just a generalized level of tension in this region that would undermine development and that would create serious concerns right across Asia, and ultimately involve the United States in various ways.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Robert Templer. He's a journalist and a writer on Asian political issues. He is also the director of the Asia Program at the International Crisis Group. And we're talking here about relations between China, Korea, and Japan. And if you have questions, comments, you can call in 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, where here where we are. We do also have that toll-free line, and we have somebody on that line we'll get right to, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in Chicago, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm a little late to the program, so I hope you'll bear with me. But is it true that in 1994... the Clinton administration considered military action against North Korea if they couldn't come to some kind of a agreement?
Yes, they got very close to that. They were drawing up plans for the bombing of nuclear targets across North Korea. They were very reluctant to take that step, but they eventually ended up getting into talks with North Koreans, and from that came a framework agreement.
Well, I gather that they're worried because they're afraid that North Korea might sell a weapon to some terrorist group like Al-Qaeda, for instance.
Yes, that's always been a fairly major concern, although the North Koreans have always said that they would never do that. But having said that, they've also been involved in various acts of proliferation of missiles and things, too.
Well, that's true. It would also cause an arms race in Asia. Like you said, I think Japan would go nuclear within a year.
Well, there's a bit of debate about that. The Japanese themselves, we've done many interviews in Tokyo on this particular issue, and we've talked to policymakers and a whole array of different political figures, and they all maintain that they would probably not do that because of the fear of a popular backlash within Japan. The opposition to nuclear weapons in Japan is very ingrained.
Well, they're the only country that's had them used during wartime. Mm. If America and North Korea did have a clash, now I don't think it would be like Desert Storm. It'd be considerably harder. It would take about, 3 months to defeat them, but it would cost thousands of lives, right?
Well, certainly. I mean, there are believed to be something in the region of 8,000 underground structures in North Korea. I've been to North Korea, and all North Koreans are taught from the earliest possible age that the United States is going to invade and that they need to learn to fight against the United States. This is drummed into them every opportunity across Pyongyang. There are huge posters of American soldiers carrying out atrocities. All the museums in North Korea are about American soldiers and what they allegedly did during the Korean War. This is a country that focuses its entire energy on this notion that America is going to invade any minute. I mean, that's obviously not going to happen, but there certainly wouldn't be people waving flowers at American troops.
Yeah, if Korea were to become united, I think it would be very difficult for our troops over there.
It would certainly lead to a considerable realignment of that relationship. It would be very hard to see how the U.S. could maintain a presence in a united Korea.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Oh, all right, thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We were talking a little bit earlier about some of the various tensions that exist between the countries, and just before we took the caller, you touched on one subject, and perhaps I'll give you the chance to talk about it just a little bit more, and that has to do with disputes over territory that are at heart about the control of natural resources, I guess oil being the major one. And here there are disputes involving very tiny bits of territory, little islands that sound like basically they're just rocks in the middle of the ocean. But what's important to the three countries is what's underneath, and that is what the concern about is about.
Well, that's right. There are two really critical claims. One is over an island that's known as Tokto. The other is over the Senkaku Islands, which are also claimed by Taiwan. And then Japan also has a claim over what it calls the Northern Territories, and that's a dispute with Russia. But the issues here are really not these tiny little specks. I mean, these are rocks that barely emerge from the sea, and they're certainly not really habitable in any way. But the issue is the surrounding area. These are countries that are all energy importers. They all have an enormous hunger for energy at the moment. They're very keen to maintain as much control over the surrounding seabed as possible, even if they're not actively exploring in these areas. So there are risks surrounding that. I mean, there are also opportunities as well. There are a great many areas around the world where there's joint development of energy resources under the sea. There have been disputes that have been worked out in the past. The agreement between Australia and East Timor, for example, on the development of the Timor Gap reserves is a model of how this might be done in some ways. So there are opportunities there for joint development. But at the moment, given the level of diplomatic tension and the sort of ferocious nationalism in each of the countries, any politician who suggested joint cooperation would probably be shouted down in public. And so very few people are willing to talk in that sort of cooperative language at the moment.
Mm-hmm. This subject of nationalism is one I'm interested in having you expand upon, because it's certainly something that has we're seeing more of it, and it is getting more attention. And as you say, it's something that has the potential, perhaps already has, in just making things more difficult. And we have seen, for example, demonstrations in China, which certainly must have been sanctioned at some level by the Chinese government, or they would not have happened. Demonstrations in China against Japan, going back again to the Japanese conduct before and during World War II. And similar kinds of things go in on the other countries. And it seems often to involve young people, people who certainly would not have been old enough to have been personally involved in certainly not in World War II. How does one account for this rising nationalism?
Well, I think each of these countries has become more assertive in their own way, and the younger generations are less inclined to be bound up in the history and some of the taboos that went along with that history. In China, you've seen the government really actively use anti-Japanese feeling as a way to develop nationalism in this country. The Communist Party, in some ways, has struggled with legitimacy since the Tiananmen Square massacres. And it's used nationalism as a way to regain some of that legitimacy. And so it's set up museums, for example, about Japanese atrocities around the country. It's promoted the issue quite assiduously. And it has worked very hard with its younger people to develop a sort of stronger sense of Chinese nationalism. And this really comes across when you look at, for example, discussions on websites and the riots that took place last year. In Korea, you have a similar resurgence of Korean nationalism and Korean identity, and that's been a very important political development. You've had a real generational shift in politics there, away from the generation that grew up under the military dictatorship, to a more democratic generation, a generation that's from a different region of the country, that's more connected to everything from labor unions and all sorts of other groups, and less connected to the military. In Japan, you've got, again, a new generation that's grown up really without any particular memories of the war or the inhibitions that surrounded it in Japan. And they, again, are a bit more assertive. You've got a prime minister in Japan that's much more willing to use national feelings and to exploit them in a political way than previous prime ministers have been able to. And he's been a very popular prime minister within Japan and very successful in some ways. So in each of these countries, you have a number of political forces at work that are using nationalism, developing it among younger people, trying to shift away from, for example, in Japan, a more reticent model of nationalism to a much more assertive one. And again, in China, trying to shift away from communism to the market economy and a sort of nationalism that still promotes the Communist Party in power. And in Korea, this big generational shift that has really transformed politics then.
Mm-hmm. In Japan, the criticism of the Japanese and the way the Japanese talk about their activities in World War II, the criticism of the Japanese has been that the Japanese have said something like, well, yes, we did bad things, but let's not forget, here again, I'm saying this with the Japanese say, well, let's not forget Japan was also a victim in the war, was also damaged, and they perhaps also would take it a step further and say that the Chinese and the Koreans overstate the evil that the Japanese did in China and Korea. And for that, the Koreans, and that makes the Koreans and the Chinese very angry, because they feel that the Japanese simply haven't stepped up to the plate and said, yes, we did it and we're sorry and here's what we're willing to do to make up for it. If you look at the attitudes of people in Japan, I guess I could understand how someone who had lived through the war experience might take that position that says, well, yes, we did that bad things, but Japan was also a victim in the war. Is it equally true? Is it more true that younger people who, say, had been born since, would also want to take that same position and say, well, you know, yes, maybe we did some bad things, but let's not forget that Japan was a victim too?
Well, it's interesting to compare the post-war histories of Japan and Germany on this issue, because in Germany you had a real sense of accountability of a nation that was profoundly apologetic and remorseful in various ways, political leaders who put it at the center of their politics. In Japan, that was just never the case. In 1958, Japan closed the file on war crimes. And that was exactly the same year when West Germany opened up a special office to prosecute war criminals and went on to prosecute more than 6,500 people, or convict 6,500 people. Nobody in Japan has been convicted of war crimes since that time. A lot of the apologies the Japanese came out with were those sort of weaselly apologies that we hear politicians the world over making. Considerable use of what I always call the passive exonerative tense. Mistakes were made, but nobody actually saying who made the mistakes or who carried out the actions. Those sorts of apologies that you hear often where they say, oh, well, I'm very sorry if anyone's taken offense at what I've done, that seem to be sort of trying to wriggle out of the apologies. So a lot of the Japanese rhetoric on this and a lot of the Japanese actions has been seen by outsiders as really trying to minimize their actual culpability. And again, the claims that they suffered horrendously are really amplified by the post-war emphasis of Japanese history, which is very much on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, on the sufferings of Japanese, on their unique status as the only country against which nuclear weapons have been used. All of these issues really grate on the surrounding people in Asia, many of whom did suffer appalling atrocities at the hands of the Japanese. I mean, there really can be no denying. One can dispute the numbers of people who were, say, killed in the Nanjing massacre, but one cannot dispute that there was a Nanjing massacre, and that's what a lot of Japanese actually do. And likewise, the chemical and biological experiments on human beings that were done in China, all of these issues never really been fully addressed by the Japanese. They still have a tendency to gloss over so much of this history. You know, this history is very real to people. I mean, there are still women in Korea and China who were forced into sexual slavery as so-called comfort women, who've endured horrendous lives as a result of official Japanese policies and yet have never been really compensated. Whereas in Germany, you've seen considerable efforts to compensate people, to establish memorials, to take really profound symbolic steps. the critical moment came in the early 1970s when the then German Chancellor Willy Brandt fell to his knees in front of the memorial in the ghetto memorial in Warsaw and apologized profoundly for German crimes. No step like that was ever taken by a Japanese leader. I think the opportunity came when the Emperor Hirohito died and was replaced by his son Akihito. If Akihito had taken that step, if he had really made an apology, then you could have cleansed a lot of the problems from World War II out of the system and won a lot of friends across Asia. But the politicians at the time never allowed him to take that step, and unfortunately that opportunity was missed, and now it's very difficult for a Japanese prime minister to apologize without coming across as false and insincere.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. I have a caller we'll get right to. Let me just again introduce our guest, Robert Templer. He's director of the Asia Program at the International Crisis Group, and as director, oversees projects that cover Central Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, and Northeast Asia. He has background as a journalist and writer on Asian political issues. Back in the late 90s, he worked for Agence France-Presse and reported from Vietnam and wrote a book about the country and about his experiences, a book that is now still available in a paperback edition published by Penguin. The title of his book is Shadows and Wind, A View of Modern Vietnam. He's also been a former visiting scholar at University of California at Berkeley. And questions are welcome here as we continue to talk about politics in Northeast Asia, relations between China, Japan, Korea. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Urbana to talk with, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. You were talking earlier about how the tensions tend to rise, but there's no real attitude of being able to discuss and work problems out. And that got me to thinking that when it comes to education, it makes me wonder what's going on as far as those people in Asia that were educated here in the U.S., are they not rising to positions of leadership? We've had years of Asian foreign students coming here, but it seems as if it's really had no impact. Would you agree with that, or do you have some different...
Well, it has had a profound impact on all these countries, but in China, you still don't really have the top levels, the generation that went through educational training in the United States. But even if you have been to the United States, it's not necessarily going to shift your own view of your own nation. That's something that's formed much earlier, I think, in life, I think, and formed by forces that are outside of the control or influence of U.S. education system. But I think in China, for example, there is a generation that's coming up. It's a mistake, though, to view that education in a more open society like the United States doesn't necessarily make those people more open when they go back home. And likewise, it's often a mistake to imagine that a younger generation that's coming up is going to be more liberal on a lot of these issues than the older generation. That's not always the case, and particularly not in these countries where you're seeing a real resurgence of nationalism. Often it's the younger people who are taking much tougher stances on these issues than their parents did. So, unfortunately, I don't think U.S. education's had a huge influence on these issues.
Hmm. That's very interesting. Thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is someone here in Champaign County, where we are, line four. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I wonder if the issues have to do with something to do with the various Asian cultures. Both Chinese, Korea, and Japan share certain Confucian and Buddhist traditions. Because just as much as you said, there hasn't been an apology from the Japanese to the Chinese for the Nanjing massacre and the biological. In the same sense, I haven't seen the Chinese ever acknowledge that they did anything wrong when they conquered Tibet and all the things that they did in connection to that. I haven't seen any real examination of the some of the chaos during the Cultural Revolution under Mao. I don't see much apologizing for any of that, or for even what the mistakes of the Mao era. So maybe there's something on both sides.
You're entirely right about all of that. China and the Communist Party in particular suffers from incredible amnesia about a whole array of atrocities. Far more people died under appalling policies of the Communist Party in China, the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, than died under the Japanese. Chinese government's inflicted much more violence on its own people than the Japanese government ever inflicted on the Chinese, and yet that is totally whitewashed. The only vague acknowledgement was that Mao was, I believe, 70% correct and 30% wrong or something in the official judgment, but certainly there's been relatively little in the way of official reassessments of the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward and these various policies, although there's obviously a widespread acknowledgement within China that these were terrible policies that had a huge, horrible impact on the country. I think across Asia you find a real reluctance for governments to look into these things, and often it's very contentious and difficult when they do it. In South Korea, the government there recently launched a campaign to sort of look back at the past of various people in terms of who had collaborated with the Japanese during the colonial period. And this immediately dredged up the backgrounds of various politicians whose families had been involved in businesses with the Japanese or had collaborated. And it immediately caused sort of immense tension and embarrassment within the society. And so these are issues that are incredibly difficult for all countries to examine. Unfortunately, what you don't have, I mean, in this country, for example, you have an array of academic historians, of others who are constantly producing work that challenges the official version, that challenges ideas about history. There's a constant sort of discussion and debate, and I think that's a very healthy thing. That hasn't come up in Asia nearly as much, and in these three countries, to varying degrees, lack that sort of real openness about historical discussion.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Going back to one of the points that you touched on, one of the points of dispute between Korea and Japan goes back again to the conduct of the Japanese in World War II, and their enslavement of Korean girls and women made them sexual slaves to serve Japanese troops. These are the women that the euphemism that has been coined, and it was by someone who was Japanese apparently to refer to them was the comfort women, and that there has been a great deal of anger in Korea and feeling that Japan should pay reparations to women who were comfort women, and that hasn't been forthcoming. There are apparently some people that think that, and I don't know to what extent people actually think this in Korea, but think that perhaps if the Japanese aren't going to do it, that the Korean government is going to have to do it, or perhaps should do it.
Well, I think the pressure is still really there on the Japanese government, although the legal process, the legal claims that these women have made against the Japanese government have constantly been rebuffed after grinding their way through this painfully slow judicial system in Japan. There's still considerable pressure there on the Japanese government to set up some sort of fund. The Japanese position is that these claims were dealt with under the peace treaties that were signed when they established diplomatic relations. They did actually pay the South Korean government a considerable amount of money in the 1960s, and that money actually sort of kick-started Korean development and the Korean economic successes that we see today, or it certainly helped to do that. They maintain that all claims were covered in that agreement, and from a purely legalistic point of view, that's certainly correct. What's unfortunate is that no Japanese prime minister has really had the political courage to stand up and say these women were treated in the most appalling manner possible, and we're a rich and successful country, and we should do what we can to recognize the suffering of these women and to compensate them. These were 16-year-old girls who were taken from their homes against their will, forced into prostitution, often being forced to have sex with literally dozens and dozens of men a day for years on end. I mean, a great many of them didn't survive this terrible ordeal. Their suffering really should be recognized, and the Japanese government sort of legalistic quibbling about it is something that just rankles all across Asia, not just in these countries, but all over the place. And it's something where they could have done so much more to have eased the tensions on this if they just had a politician who is willing to stand up and say, you know, we have a real need to address this in a humane and sensible manner, not through legalistic quibbling. So I think there's still a reluctance for South Korean government to be the one that compensates it when there is a feeling that the Japanese government should be the one that still does that.
Well, if a Japanese prime minister would do this, stand up and do this, would the concern, say, among the government of Japan, would the concern be that the Japanese people would react and say, well, the prime minister shouldn't have said that because it wasn't correct or because it makes Japan look bad?
Well, the real pressure point here is the very far-right groups in Japan who are very, very noisy and well-organized. They are quite literally noisy in the sense that any politician who goes against their view of the world will have a vehicle parked outside his office that will blare away noise through loudspeakers denouncing him. These groups are quite powerful. They're embarrassing to politicians. They go out of their way to sort of go after any politician who is willing to stand up and make any concessions on these issues. They have a very narrow, very extreme view of Japanese history. Unfortunately, Japanese politicians are all too eager often to bow to these groups. Also, the very conservative factions of the LDP have considerable weight. I mean, these are rich people, powerful people politically. And there's a sense that among these people that the war is all in the past, that these issues shouldn't be dredged up. Japan should not have to suffer the embarrassment of discussing these issues over and over, and that the complaints from Korea and China are unjustified, and that Japan should be more assertive and just reject discussion on this issue further. The people who take that view have considerable influence in Japanese politics.
One hesitates to bring the United States into this because its intervention is not always welcome and not always productive. But having said that, are there some things you think that the government of the United States could do to help in trying to encourage these countries to do the kinds of things that you recommend, is to do what they can to loosen military tension, to agree in a productive way to exploit resources for everyone's interest, to address some of these various questions? Is there something the United States could do to help?
Yes. I mean, there are a number of things. I think that helping these countries sort of establish some form of security cooperation, some forum in which to discuss these issues, maybe something along the lines of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which has been quite a useful talking shop since it was set up under the Helsinki Agreements to deal with a whole variety of security and other issues. It's quite good at least to have some forum in which these issues can be discussed, even if they're not necessarily resolved immediately. I think the United States needs to look at its relationship with each of these countries and to examine what are problematic in those relationships in themselves and to what degree the U.S. relationship exacerbates some of these tensions. The U.S., for example, has been developing a much closer security relationship with Japan and promoting this idea that Japan should become a more normal normal country in terms of security. And that's causing a lot of anxiety in South Korea and China. So that issue hasn't been well handled by this administration. Likewise, the relationship between Washington and Seoul is not in great shape at the moment. The relationship with China, again, is shaky on some of these areas. So there are certain things that the United States could do. The resolution of the issue of North Korea is a really critical issue, and that's something where the U.S. has a leading role. Really, the agreement, if it ever happens, will be between, essentially, the United States and North Korea. The surrounding countries may have some role. It'll be signed up to under the six-party talks that have been going on in Beijing, but the critical agreement is between Pyongyang and Washington. That would go a long way to changing some of the dynamics in Northeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. One can certainly find reasons to be critical of the Clinton administration and its policy toward North Korea, but I think some people would say at the very least that there was this attempt not only to use the stick but also to use the carrot and to try to address the concerns of the North, particularly for dealing with their energy needs. It seems that the North, it seems that they want to have something like a more normal relationship with the rest of the world, but at the same time that they feel threatened by the outside, particularly by the United States. So you would say that the it may the moves of the Clinton administration may have been imperfect, but at least that they tried, and that they faced difficulty with the Congress, with Republicans in the Congress, who apparently weren't interested in making nice with the North Koreans. And then the Bush administration comes into office, and it's just very belligerent, at least in terms of its rhetoric, right out of the box, which doesn't seem terribly productive. What can you say about what the United States has done, particularly now with the change of the administrations from Clinton to Bush?
Well, when the Bush administration came in, their policy was the so-called ABC policy, anything but Clinton. Bill Clinton had got very, very close to an agreement with the North Koreans on both nuclear weapons and missiles. North Koreans did subsequently cheat on a previous agreement, although both sides failed to live up to the agreement in various ways, although the North Koreans do share a greater measure of culpability there. But since then, we've had really just a complete lack of a policy. For the past 5 years, North Korea has been essentially free to make more nuclear material, to possibly develop that material into nuclear weapons, to continue the development of its missile program. And in the meantime, there's been a lot of heated rhetoric coming out of Washington, but no real policy. And the problem is that there's still very serious divisions within this administration on how to handle North Korea. You have those, Dick Cheney and the group around him, the neoconservative group, who feel that North Korea is going to collapse, and therefore one may as well just push it towards that and wait until it essentially the rotten fruit falls from the tree. That's not going to happen. It's simply not going to collapse. This is not a country that looks anywhere close to collapse. I've traveled all around the country, and I can tell you it's incredibly impoverished. It's a pitiful place in many ways and a horrifyingly repressive place, but it's certainly not a place where you see the signs of sort of degradation and failure that you've seen in say, Afghanistan. It's another country I've spent quite a lot of time in. So I don't think it's anywhere close to collapse. It still has a government that's very much in control. The other side is those who've wanted to negotiate, and Condoleezza Rice has generally fallen into this camp, and she has pressed forward with negotiations. The problem with that is that the U.S. government's not really making credible offers at those talks. There really needs to be an offer to bring North Korea into the fold, to offer certain economic incentives, and to try and create an environment in which they feel a bit more secure. They're not going to make a deal from a position of insecurity. That's not the way they've ever operated. They're going to make a deal if they feel a bit more secure. Now, it's very difficult in some ways, given the nature of the regime and all the problems with it, for the U.S. government to sort of be a bit more generous. It's certainly difficult politically in Washington at the moment, but I think it's ultimately the only way in which you'd ever be able to reach an agreement is to essentially recognize that this is a weak country, it's playing a weak hand, but it needs to be treated. What it really wants is a certain degree of respect, and offering that respect is not a great concession on the part of the U.S. When this is really a very pitiful place more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. What sort of concrete gesture then would be good for a first kind of a step to try to, in a sense, to draw the North Koreans out a little bit?
Well, I think a clear sort of economic plan. I mean, what the North Koreans have been told is, give up your nuclear weapons and then we will consider some sort of assistance. I think what is needed is a step-by-step plan that says, essentially, when you do this step towards ending your weapons program, you will get this benefit. There's a way of doing that under which Japan and South Korea foot most of the bill itself rather than U.S. taxpayers. But it needs to be done with a level of U.S. engagement. I think a first step, if one really wanted to resolve this problem, would be to send a very high-level envoy to Pyongyang to work a deal out personally with Kim Jong-il. Nobody else in Korea can really make a deal. So every time you're negotiating with somebody who's a bit lower down in the food chain, it still has to go back to Pyongyang. That's where the problems start. If you can negotiate face-to-face with him, then I think it would be possible to then get a deal in the context of the six-party talks. But until that happens, I don't see any progress there. One of the problems is, of course, in Washington, is that it's very much a one-issue city. The big foreign policy issue is Iraq. Next on the list is Iran. And then there are a host of other things. And North Korea has very much fallen off the radar screen in Washington.
We are just about at the point that we're going to have to finish up. Any last sort of thought that you'd like to leave people with?
Well, I think this area is troubling in a great many ways, and it's certainly one that deserves a bit more attention, a bit more attention in Washington, a bit more attention among these countries to make sure that the bickering that's been going on doesn't erupt into a much greater level of tension. Mm. I think we need to be aware of the potential dangers of conflict in this region and be working much more hard to prevent that conflict, to make sure that it just never, ever gets down the path towards outright confrontation between these countries.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Good, thank you.
Our guest, Robert Templer, is director of the Asia Program at the International Crisis Group. He's a journalist and writer on Asian political issues, author of the book Shadows and Wind, A View of Modern Vietnam, based on some of his experience as a journalist in Vietnam. And by the way, if you're interested in finding out more about the Crisis Group and looking at some of the research that they have done on various issues around the world, you can go to their website, which is www.crisisgroup.org. Programming here on WILL made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates, currently handling over 30% of the real estate sales transactions in Champaign County. Information at 352-5700. RE/MAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. We're going to take a break, as we usually do at this point. When we continue with Focus 580, we'll be talking with a poet. Her name is Ruth Ellen Coker. She teaches at the University of Missouri in St. Louis, has had several collections of her work published, has won a couple of major awards, and she is here visiting the campus to talk with students and also to read some of her work. And that's what we'll be doing in the next part of the show. So I hope you will stay with us. Right now, however, we'll take our usual break. We'll have news from National Public Radio and an update on the markets.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at AM 580. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606. Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets, where Chicago Board of Trade May soybean futures fell about 10 cents per bushel by this morning, with sell stops hit as the market dipped below key moving averages after dipping below its 50-day moving average yesterday. It is now below both its 20 and 100-day moving averages. Meanwhile, we're looking to see the wheat also lower today.